young fella.
Mother planet, you make me feel so small. Spring, summer, winter procession, and of course the fall. You've seen it all. You've seen it all.
The history of 420 in three acts. Act 1. You can trace a line from Jack Kerouac and Neil Cassidy to Ken Kesey and Ken Babbs to Steve and Dave, who entered San Rafael High School in the late 60s. They were rugged individualists, uninspired by the social scene, which centered on athletics and the school's top jocks. So they decided to create their own fun by embarking on a quest for adventure. The first of these was a visit to a Bay Area research lab developing the very first hologram. Soon, Jeff, Larry, and Mark joined the safaris as these adventures became known. Every safari started with a sacramental hit of cannabis, followed by the cranking of the tunes, either in the 1966 four-door Chevy Impala with the killer Craig 8-track system stereo, or in Steve's room, or in one of the other sacred spots they shared herb, as getting high was illegal and couldn't be done in public or around parents. One of their favorite spots was underneath the statue of Louis Pasteur by Benny Bufano, which overlooked the school parking lot. Sacred hymns provided by the New Riders of the Purple Sage, Allman Brothers, Poco, Commander Cody, Beatles, the Moonlighters, were then employed to lift the vibration higher. This crew gravitated to a wall inside the courtyard of the San Rafael High, where they'd meet before class and during lunch break to make withering comments about everything around them. And this is where they obtained their name, the Waldos, as well as where they honed their savage wit. You couldn't smoke pot around school unless it was a one-hitter and done extremely carefully, and even then you risked suspension and your parents' wrath. In the fall of 1971, Steve was given a treasure map to an abandoned patch of cannabis on Point Reyes that had been planted by a member of the Coast Guard too scared to return to retrieve it. He wanted some fellow stoners to have the patch, and everybody at San Rafael knew the Waldos were frequent stoners. Surely, this is the ultimate safari, thought Steve. No more adventurous nor noble quest could be devised by the mind of man. The Waldos prophetically all agreed to meet at 4:20 p.m. at the Louis Pasteur statue to get high and drive out to Point Reyes to search for the secret patch of weed. From then on, whenever the Waldos passed each other in the halls, they spontaneously erupted in a salute with the words, 420, Louis. Little did they know how far this ritual would eventually travel, although Louis got lost along the way. For the next 10 years, the Waldos went on the most amazing safaris and had the most magical adventures, although they sadly never found that patch. But they always sponsored a big pot party on April 20th, where a ceremonial toke would take place at 4:20 p.m. Eventually, they started getting married, having families, and picking up the sacred pipe much less frequently. However, they kept up the safaris. But soon after the Waldos retired from 420 ceremonies, younger classmen of San Rafael High picked up on the magic of numerology and began using the code as a way to evade detection, and some of them started a ritual of congregating on a ridge of Mount Tamalpais with a sunset view of the Pacific on April 20th in order to get high at exactly 4:20 p.m. as a way to honor the spirit of cannabis. This ritual started with only a few souls, but soon grew to dozens. And that's when someone got the idea of making a flyer inviting all stoners to the ceremony. Nobody outside Marin County even knew that 420 signified pot. But even those gathered at the top of Mount Tam didn't have any idea of how the code had started. They thought it had something to do with the police. Act 2. I'm often knee-deep before I realize what I stepped into, and that's how it was with the Cannabis Cup. The idea came to me on the plane while flying back from the Netherlands after interviewing the founder of the first marijuana seed company, Neville Schoenmakers. The night before, Dave Watson had regaled me with tales of California harvest festivals before camp helicopters forced that scene underground. Soon, I was back in the Netherlands organizing the first Cannabis Cup with a photographer and grow expert. Three seed companies entered, and one of them didn't even cure their entries, but plucked them fresh off the vine. But when I returned home after that first event, I couldn't shake a feeling of responsibility. My event demanded a ceremonial framework respecting the true spirit of cannabis and its historical importance and influence. And that's how I ended up buying a paperback version of the Rig Veda. Imagine my surprise when I came across the description of the primary sacrament shared during all ceremonies, a drink called Soma. The blind see, the lame walk, he clothes the naked. Soma is a sage and seer, inspired by poetry, king of the healing plants. I knew Soma was supposed to be a mushroom, something accepted as gospel by the academic community, but in my heart, I instantly realized that this had to be a description of cannabis, and there had to be some incredible cover-up going on that dwarfed the cover-up Jack Hare was pushing about the industrial uses and environmental benefits of hemp. I stepped out of my office to smoke a joint and reflect on these matters, something I had been doing in my office, but had recently departed, as I had moved to a former warehouse in the back of the building, something necessitated by a crackdown on smoking in the front office. But the crackdown had just been extended to my refuge in the former warehouse, so I was forced into a stairwell. The recently appointed news editor was there, along with a member of the Cannabis Action Network from the Bay Area who was dropping off a flyer. There was also some hippie dude I didn't know who proceeded to pull out a stash of whippets and he began inhaling them in rapid succession. The news editor asked when he was going to share, and he said, "Sorry, I only have my dose and nothing more." I fired my joint while the dude from CAN showed me a flyer that had been circulated at a Grateful Dead show in Oakland. "Check this out," he said, "it's really silly. I don't have immensatory moments often, but I've been traveling through the Vedas for hours and still had a foot in the distant past. So when I saw that crude flyer asking people to come to the Sunset View Ridge of Mount Tam at 4:20 p.m. on April 20th, it assumed biblical proportions in my mind, and I expressed these feelings instantly. Because this was surely a sign and something that could be employed to give deeper meaning to my Cannabis Cup ceremony." But for those not into numerology or the study of secret societies, this sort of thinking is silliness with no meaning. Some people got 420 and used the magic to enhance their experience and legitimize pot and ceremony. Well, for others, it just remained a funny excuse to light up and nothing more. I told my staff that day I intended to use the code to build a case for spiritual rights under the Constitution. "This ceremony manifested spontaneously and is evidence of the power of cannabis to create ceremony and culture," I said. "We're going to make this a big part of the Cannabis Cup and the Freedom Fighters." Later on, I was crushed to discover the news editor had run a joke item about the flyer, failing to even mention my pledge to deploy the code as a fulcrum for legalization. No matter, John Holmstrom, editor of the Hemp 100 page, knew exactly what I was doing. And from that day on, a mention of 420 was on every Hemp 100, and that page had a fanatical following. Certainly Chef Jack Hare, Roger Belknap, Tom Harris, and Lyndon Noel got 420. They were the shock troops in the hemp legalization movement who helped me found the Freedom Fighters, the first national hemp legalization group. For many years, we drove to rallies in a magic bus, a new one each year as they were always breaking down. We hosted free campgrounds with free kitchens and published a free newsletter. Back then, the rallies were all held at precisely noon, a trend that would continue for well over a decade. But the Freedom Fighters always held council at 4:20 p.m., passed a feather, and plotted how to best legalize in our lifetime. Just as every year, one of the Freedom Fighters was selected by open council to attend the Cannabis Cup as a celebrity judge. I hadn't been to any cups since the first one because the publisher claimed it was just an excuse for me to go get high with my friends. So I sent other people a different one each year. But in 1993, I held the first 420 council at the Cannabis Club. In truth, it was a clumsy ceremony, as no one but me had any idea what 420 represented, including Jack Herer. Some people will claim 420 was already widespread within the Grateful Dead community in the 1980s, but this is not true. It was known to teenagers who lived in Marin County in the later part of the decade and was on the way out when I began promoting it. At the 7th Cup, the 420 ceremony blossomed and became epic and stayed that way for the next 15 years, or at least until High Times booted me out of my own event. Most of the chiefs of cannabis in Amsterdam attended that 420 ceremony and spoke from their hearts. Eagle Bill was a major force elevating those ceremonies, and it could not have happened like it did without him. I ran into Bill on my way to open the PAX Party House on opening day and noticed he carried a hand-carved staff. I asked if he would like to be the ceremonial high priest and use his staff in place of a feather. The impact of this request on Eagle Bill was profound. To say Eagle Bill got 420 would be a vast understatement, as he rapidly elevated to become the primary guiding spirit of the event. I was arranging everything around 420 in the afternoon, but the crew got so devoted they began doing 420 a.m. ceremonies, and these rapidly became the most legendary parties at the Cup, held in the Quinton lobby after the award show. Everyone collected mass selfies under a clock at exactly 420. In 1995, Vancouver got credit for staging the first April 20th 420 ceremony outside Marin County. Mark Emery, Dana Rozek, Cindy Lasso, and Ian Hunter had a hand in manifesting this event. Although Mark was initially opposed to the concept, it continues today, I suppose, as the longest-running April 20th ceremony in North America. In 1998, I staged the first New York City 420 celebration on April 20th at Wetlands, featuring the Cannabis Cup Band. In later years, the band held an April 20th celebration on board a boat that traveled around Manhattan Island. I wouldn't stage another public 420 event in New York until 2017, when the Temple Dragon Band did a free performance in Tompkins Square Park in the East Village. The Mount Tam Sunset Ridge ceremony, meanwhile, was shut down in 1990. Without the efforts of High Times, 420 likely would have died out in the early 90s. Act 3.
I'm a rolling stone, all alone and lost. For a life of fun, I paid the cost. When I pass by, all the people say,
all the people say,
just another dude,
just another dude,
on a stoner highway,
on a stoner highway,
thin rice paper,
thin rice paper,
or a pipe real small,
or a pipe real small,
a nug of kind bud,
a nug of kind bud,
makes it all worthwhile,
makes it all worthwhile.
From the day we met,
from the day we met,
my life had changed,
my life had changed,
started rolling down,
started rolling down, down
the stoner highway.
Even though High Times became the magazine success story of the 90s and the Freedom Fighters spearheaded the return of the rallies, reigniting the sleeping marijuana movement, success only seemed to bring problems for me, as I was soon forced to disband the Freedom Fighters and there was constant pressure to shut down the Cannabis Cup as well, or at least remove my supervision. I moved home to concentrate on events and how to document them for posterity, as I felt there was something important in these early 420 ceremonies. At the time, I was primarily interested in building up WEE as the premier cannabis event in North America. I've been trying for years to get Ken Kesey and the Merry Pranksters over to the Cannabis Cup and had lured Mountain Girl when she was poor and adventurous, but at one point I realized if I wanted to do a ceremony with Kesey, it was going to have to happen in his backyard. And that's what happened. The first year, 1997, we had over 300 vendors and 20,000 attendees. Of course, the pranksters got 420 immediately, and the reason the code suddenly began skyrocketing through the Grateful Dead scene was threefold. First, Rainbow Family and Dead Family are basically the same thing, and the Freedom Fighters and 420 had acquired a huge presence at Rainbow. Second, Jack Hare and Chef Ra got 420, and they were influential figures and spread the code. And three, and probably the most important, the pranksters got 420 and began actively pushing it. And Kesey was the most influential person in that scene after Jerry Garcia. One day I got an email from Mike, the travel agent of the Cannabis Cup, who had been made producer of the event with me directing the ceremonies. He forwarded a message from Steve in San Francisco, who claimed to have started 420 with his friends in 1971. The part that caught my attention was Steve wasn't seeking money. He just wanted 420tours.com to know the real story. He was writing to the Cannabis Cup travel package website because Mike had put up a forum for posting 420 Cannabis Cup stories. And this website drew the attention of the Waldos, who had been following the spread of 420 across the internet with much mirth and amazement. By 2002, head shops in the Bay Area were stuffed with 420 t-shirts, buttons, hats, posters, and various other memorabilia. The code had become a well-known secret inside cannabis culture and had been written about in High Times and celebrated as a central ceremony in the Cannabis Cup and Wii, the two biggest and most influential cannabis themes event at the time, if you don't count Kumbh Mela. Still, however, outside the Bay Area, the code remained an enigma, even to most stoners. I ended up flying out to San Francisco and meeting the Waldos and holding epic ceremonies with them for days, all of which were captured on video, as were my 420 ceremonies with the pranksters and the elders of the Rainbow Family. In fact, whenever I get together with pranksters, Waldos, or Rainbow Elders, the same magic, improvisational energy always emerges, along with an overwhelming desire to have fun. I never doubted the Waldos' story and read the truth in their hearts before I examined their documents, but the powers that be at High Times never trusted me, and the publisher spread the story I was suppressing competing tales on the origins of 420 because the Waldos were my friends, implying it was all a massive hoodwink on my part. I also began a college lecture tour in 1995, debating Curtis Sliwa for 5 years, and then the former head of the New York DEA for an additional 14 years, and Heads versus Feds traveled to over 300 colleges and universities over 19 years. I videotaped hundreds of these debates, as well as collecting local TV news coverage. The event became one of the most popular college lectures of the decade, producing standing room only audiences in multi-thousand seat theaters. The debate was so lopsided, I had to coach Bob on which points he should ditch and which ones were my weakest. Our carefully crafted performance was stuffed with stand-up comedy interspersed with moments of high drama, and instead of polarizing the audience, we drew them closer together. By the end, most everyone agreed cannabis was not for kids and should be respected and not abused. But it was also not a crime worth destroying lives over. We always had a line of medical marijuana users asking questions, some of whom were Vietnam vets begging Bob for compassion, and he provided it. But there were also hostile attacks on Bob that required my immediate tamping down. Whenever Black Belt Bob felt obligated to invite an abuser to engage in a more physical confrontation, I knew it was time for me to jump out with, "Don't blame the cops. They don't make the laws. They are trapped in this nightmare just like we are." One of my central points for legalization was prescription medications posed far more danger than cannabis, and eventually we would see tremendous devastation from overprescription of legal drugs, something that quickly became all too true. I told college kids not to intoxicate, but to concentrate on their education, although I did provide dispensation for one day only. On April 20, at 4:20 p.m., if they held a circle of hands and held a moment of silence for world peace, it was okay to partake of the peace culture sacrament. Nowhere was this embraced more ardently than Boulder, Colorado, which is why, for a brief time, Colorado grabbed the center of gravity on 420. At every debate, I invited Bob to attend the Cannabis Cup in Amsterdam, all expenses paid, so he could try cannabis for the first time. Bob always declined, and the repartee that followed produced the biggest laughs of the night. Many decades later, after Bob developed back problems, his doctor recommended cannabis. Bob did try it, and it worked. So he wrote a mea culpa for the media. I also urged students to have a peace ceremony at 4:20 on April 20th, while urging moderation, reminding them the less you do, the higher you get. and ended each debate with a plea for the creation of a local student-run legalization group and urged students to hold annual events on April 20th and have local bands play to raise money for the chapter. I promised if they made that group and held that 420 peace ceremony, I would return someday to celebrate with them. According to Alan St. Pierre, former head of Normal, without Hager, I don't think there's any way that this interesting numerology would have crept deep into American culture and commerce. But Alan remains the lone cannabis influencer who acknowledges my contribution.
I was just a boy.
Only 15.
Only 15.
Neither good or bad.
Neither good or bad.
Somewhere in between.
I got lost,
and I went astray. Couldn't stop going down the Stoner Highway.
Now, boys, don't take no breakfast dab. Unless, of course, life's become too drab.
My agent booking the debate always booked April 20th first every year, which meant I could never attend any 420 ceremonies on 420 except my own. I've long supported the position 420 is a tool for legitimizing cannabis as the sacrament of peace. I was never in favor of students doing breakfast dabs on exam days. I knew some students get overly attracted to intoxication early in life and it holds them back. But on the other hand, I never believed anyone should go to jail, lose a student loan, or custody of their kids over cannabis. Limited experimentation can be beneficial to some teens. I suggested using 4:20 p.m. as a guide for an appropriate hour for the adult population to hold cannabis ceremonies away from the children. I also granted dispensation to the students for one day annually, provided they attended a peace circle while imbibing. Sadly, in 2016, that former news editor posted a story about how he discovered 420 and failed to mention me at all. He then told a HuffPost reporter that I had nothing to do with promoting 420 and that the code took off on its own, as if my events and ceremonies had zero to do with what happened. This same person denied the story of the Waldos for years and always pointedly refused to participate in my ceremony at the office. The biggest fallacy today, spread mostly by the same person, is the code was spread through the Grateful Dead. Even Wikipedia falsely makes this claim, as if the Waldo's parents gave the code to the Dead who spread it to the followers. In fact, the Dead never mentioned 420 all through the 1990s. Meanwhile, every High Times magazine for decades was pushing 420 on the Hemp 100. That is where most deadheads picked it up. That and the hundreds of college lectures I was doing across the country urging people to celebrate the sacrament of peace culture. I'm hoping some who see this will get 420 and take their consumption to a higher level on the magic day, rather than just an excuse to get intoxicated. Only then will we be able to forge a culture worthy of being handed down to future generations. If you treat the plant with respect, there can be magic. But for those who partake without wisdom and become too attached too early in life, it mostly becomes just a very expensive habit. The other thing I've learned is that if you want to have a true counterculture ceremony, everyone must be invited, which means the ceremony has to welcome everyone, and it can't just be about stoners getting high and nothing else.
I go for sour diesel, or Gorilla Glue when I can find it. Oh, as long as it's green, but organic and well cured, you know the super kind just takes some time. Mother, mother planet, after all the years I found an occupational hazard when an occupation's just not around. Feel like I'm down.
hair.